The Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast with Bhairav Patel and Alan Clark.
Welcome to the Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast, where we tackle the practical challenges that startup founders and small business owners face and give our own unvarnished opinions. My name is Bhairav Patel. I'm the Managing Director at Atom Ventures and Atom CTO, where we partner with small businesses and startup founders to help them define and build their tech vision.
And I'm Alan Clark. I'm the founder of the Business Growth Partnership, and we work with high-potential businesses to help them unblock the blockages that are preventing them from reaching their full potential.
Hi, everybody. Welcome along to this latest edition of the Real World Entrepreneurship. We were joined by Brant Cooper all the way from San Diego. So, Brant, reading your bio, you're a speaker, an author, a blogger, a New York Times bestseller. You've got 25 years in changing mindsets in the digital age. Tell us a little bit about how that all came about.
Yeah, so your title is Real Entrepreneurship, and yet I've never really considered myself an entrepreneur. I was maybe always a round peg in a square hole, but I didn't really know what entrepreneurship was, back in the day after coming out of college. But I knew I just sort of didn't. The way I joke about it is that my managers always tossed me around like a hot potato because nobody really wanted to manage me. And I think that was because I always wanted to do things my own way. And so I kind of went from job to job looking for a home. And then I joined my first startup, and that was in the Silicon Valley area back in the late 90s. And that's where I got my first taste of what it meant to be entrepreneurial. So even though I didn't found the company, the type of people that you want to hire early on in a small business are entrepreneurial people, because you can't, as the leader, you can't waste your time managing people. You need to hire people that are going to go and figure out what needs to be done in order to drive impact. And so there, in that role, I was able to exercise my creativity and my intelligence and go try to figure things out that would drive impact for the business. And so that's sort of the entrepreneurial mindset that I write about. But so I did that for many years, lived through the dot-com boom and then the bust. And after the bust, there were a number of people that were writing and, blogging about, well, why do we look at small businesses and try to model them after big businesses? Big businesses struggle to create new growth opportunities. They fail at launching products. They fail at, trying to launch new brands and all the rest. And so I was one of those people and ended up writing the first book that talked about customer development and lean startup and product market fit. And that sort of what launched my new career in writing and speaking about these things and started my own business that basically teaches this entrepreneurial spirit to very large organizations, which is its own challenge. But I think it's my mission to teach people how to be in control of their own economy, because that's what freedom really is. And so if one can do a side hustle that earns some revenue so that they can take their family to Italy in the summer, then more power to them. If somebody wants to try to go create the next unicorn, that's great too. But really being, sort of getting out there and understanding the needs of the market and interviewing your customers and running experiments and cutting through your own biases and validating or invalidating your assumptions. That's sort of the new world that we're living in. That's what brings us to today.
Great. So you've just written a new book called Disruption Proof. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, so the Disruption Proof is, I wrote this during the pandemic. And, I'm sure you are all familiar with the idea of technology disruption. And there's a lot of startups that are going to go disrupt markets, and that's all great. But the reality is that the digital world means that we're disrupted in so many other ways beyond just technology, that things like the pandemic and supply chain issues and inflation and employees quitting and ransomware attacks and all of these things have always gone on, but they used to be isolated in different regions of the world. But the global interconnectedness that we have now and the speed of information and even, you know, misinformation means that those things ripple across all economies all across the world. And so in the middle of the pandemic, I'm writing this book about how corporates need to be more entrepreneurial. And it was just really, it just really galvanized me to come up with stories about how those companies that are agile and able to respond to changes in the market and changes to the disruption, those are the ones that are resilient. Those are the ones that are going to weather the storms of all these disruptions that are rolling across our economy. And so that's really what the book is about. The digital age means that we need to manage people and manage work differently than the middle of the industrial age. And yet most companies, most organizations are still managed in the old school way.
Most of our audience are people working in early stage startup or small businesses. So it's what you're really saying here is that they are disruption-proof by design, because they are just brought up in a world where disruption is the norm.
I think that's a great point. The problem typically is that the mentors and advisors and investors that they run into will immediately try to get them to start organizing and structuring their company like the big companies. And so over time, they will become less disruption-proof. And so that's really the message for the entrepreneurs and the startups of the world, is they have to maintain their agile culture. And it's very difficult to do, especially when getting pressure from outside forces that say that you need to do it differently.
That absolutely resonates, because certainly my time working with large corporations, it was really amazing to the extent which they said we have to be entrepreneurial in our approach. We have to delegate authority. We have to decentralize. And then it stopped at that point because they didn't know how to do it. Because we want to decentralize and empower people, providing they're doing what we want to do, how we want them to do it.
Right. No, I mean, that's spot on. So a quick example of that will be that most startups, most small businesses will start organizing their company based upon function. And so you'll have your engineering and your marketing and your sales. And as those grow, they become, you know, sort of working on their best practices. The leadership will want to protect their time. And so they'll start restricting access to those functions by the other functions. And so suddenly what you get into a situation where you're not agile at all. Everything is done very linearly. In order to launch a new product, then, you know, you come up with the idea and then you put it to engineering and then you put it to marketing and then you put it to sales and then you put out the operations and all the rest. And it's a very linear approach, and it's not very responsive to changes that might occur or things that you got wrong. So it takes a lot more time to fix things. And if you look at it the other way around, if you look at it as a cross-functional team, it's interdisciplinary, and they're going to tackle all of those different parts of figuring out a business model. They're responsible for all of those type of problems. Now you've got a team of people that are organized around a mission, and you know, diversity has proven that you're going to come up with solutions better than if you have a bunch of like-minded people going after uncertainty. So I think it's just there's no reason really to organize your company around function. And so we have this idea called team of teams or cascading missions, where you're equipping your teams like a special forces team based upon what their mission is, not based upon, oh, well, this team has this particular function. And so it's a different way to look at it, though it is exactly as you say, startups behave that way naturally. And it's only when they try to scale that they have to start to organize. And to be honest, I think that organizing based upon function is arbitrary. And it's really based upon the simplicity, the relative simplicity, the relative lack of complexity of the middle of the industrial age compared to the digital age.
Right. Okay.
So one of the things, just to step in there now. So what I find quite interesting here is that I work in one of the projects I'm working on is a crypto crypto project. It's actually blockchain based business, but we're in the crypto world to some extent. And one of the things that you obviously hear about there a lot is decentralization, right? And DAOs coming in. And not to say within my own project, but you see other projects that are trying to decentralize and become DAOs. And the initial thing that you see is that there becomes a huge overhead that is there through decentralization, simply because you end up having lots of people in different areas all having say in parts that they probably don't need to have a say in. And because the lines are not really very well drawn, it becomes very confusing as to who should make a decision, when they should make that decision, and then who should implement that decision. And I think I definitely agree with what you're saying in that, you know, startups do end up becoming more structured. But I think the couple of issues around that is because, well, the couple of reasons for that is because if you're in a regulatory environment, then you kind of have to be in that space, right? But the second thing is really that people, as you hire, those kinds of people that can work in a little bit more of an agile way or in a group way are very different from the ones that you end up hiring as you move along, right? Because, I mean, I've worked in organizations where we've hired, let's say I'm in tech, so then you hire some developers, and the early guys you bring on board, they can do lots of different things. They're quite willing to change. If the product's not working, they're there to change it. Whereas, you know, after you start scaling that team, you get people on board who really just want to do what they've been told and don't really want to do anything else. And if you suddenly change what they're trying to do, then they all go a bit crazy and say, well, no, I want to do this. And so,
yeah, totally agree with that. Yeah.
And so all these different factors come in play. So I think it for me, it's, you can, decentralization I love, but it tends to be done really badly.
And, right.
And then when you get into scaling the teams, what you find is you hit the brick wall with people. So how do you overcome at least the personality issue that you have there?
Right. So so I want people to think about it in terms of uncertainty versus the lack of uncertainty. So the people that want to just be told what to do need to be working in a part of the organization that has low levels of uncertainty. So things have already been figured out. And so so they have the blueprint on how to do whatever it is that they do. So decentralization is not a free-for-all. So that's why I talk about missions. What you really want to be able to do is structure an organization such that you can draw a straight line from people's work to business outcomes. And that's kind of not the way a functional organization looks like. The functional organization has your strategic priorities, but by the time you get down to the, you know, sort of the ground floor level, you're just managing tasks. You're not managing outcomes. And so even if people are working on an execution-only, low uncertainty environment, number one, I believe they should still be put on a team. So you can call it an agile team. It's just faces low level of uncertainty. But the team actually is going to hold each other accountable to the quality of the work. And they get to determine sort of what it is that needs to be done in order to accomplish their mission. So it really comes down to how you're defining that low uncertainty team's mission. If what they're doing is building back-end code that's been built a million times, that's fine. You can understand what that mission is. But that team should be still, you want the social construct of a team to hold those teams accountable to the work and to the ethics, the behavior. And it really frees up the time of managers to be more proactive and strategic rather than having to put out the fires of the individual. So I think that I'm totally in agreement with you. I think that the agile structure still works. Agile was actually not born, and lean was not born in high uncertainty environments. They were in very structured environments, but you need to empower people to do continuous improvement, which is really also dealing with certain amounts of low amounts of uncertainty. And so you want to, even among those people, spur their creativity and their intelligence. Even if they don't think that they want it, they will feel more engaged with the company. So I like to think about it as the difference between an army unit, which still has a squads and their teams, and a special forces unit. The special forces is very cross-functional and dealing with lots of uncertainty. The army unit is dealing with low level of uncertainty. They're very like-minded, and they're just more in execution mode, but there's still a team orientation there.
So is this all measured by outcomes, or is it measured just by other way? Are there other kind? Is it just purely outcome measurement then, or like an outcome metric, or are there other metrics that you can still have in these kinds of teams?
Well, I think that the individuals still need their own mentoring and their own guidance in terms of their skill development. So I imagine more of a cross-functional or more of a matrix reporting, where there's one that's just, is the team accomplishing its missions? And then the other is about the individual and whether they're having the career that they want, and are they getting along with others, and those type of things. And so I think that reporting side should not be the same reporting side as the performance based on the mission. So you see these types of matrix organizations in companies like Spotify, for instance, or Zappos, where they're really allowing a little bit more freedom of the individual to find the work that they want to do, but they're still held accountable to performance. And I think that that's the number one thing that we want to see. Not did you accomplish these 10 tasks that I gave you, but did the outcome achieve what it was supposed to achieve?
So I hear you mentioning that, and that kind of maybe throws a spanner in where I was getting to with the thinking here, which was, is there a scale at which this no longer works? Because it certainly seems like the smaller the organization, the easier it is to be that cross-functional dynamic team. The larger it becomes, the harder it is to give everybody freedom while still moving the whole organization towards a point. Have you found any metrics or any correlation at certain sizes where it becomes more difficult to do this?
I think that there's a lot of things still to figure out. I think it is more difficult, but I'm not sure it isn't more difficult just because it's not the standard way of doing it. So it's more difficult in finding the people that have experience with it or know how to do it. But I mean, I think that there are
those people exist in small organizations. So I think back to one of the businesses I worked in, where we had 40 relatively high-performing, skilled members of staff. And the managing director's view was, I'm just letting you log on with it. I'm not here to tell you what to do. You all know what you need to do. And my job is to kind of gently nudge you in the right direction. But when you move to a business with 400 staff or 4,000 staff, holy smoke, it could be absolute chaos.
Well, see, I don't think it has to be chaos, right? I mean, So ING has done this, and they've got 50,000 people. So and Spotify is also not a small company. So, I mean, I think that the key is to differentiate between what does the team makeup look like when there's massive amounts of uncertainty and when there's low amounts of uncertainty. And that's a continuum across the organization. So if you looked at functional groups inside of a company like an HR group, they have low amounts of uncertainty, but they have uncertainty still. What is the right way to do performance management? How do we recruit the people that we need inside the company? How do we retain employees? There's a lot of uncertainty there. Those teams can work very entrepreneurial through that uncertainty, very much like an agile team. And yet they're a bunch of HR professionals. So I think that if you were to look at an organization of hundreds of people or thousands of people, and you said, well, can I manage them based upon giving teams missions, or do I have to manage the tasks of every individual? You would think that the latter would be more complex than the former. We only view it as being less complex because it's the way we've always done it. But managing people to missions that directly impact the company, it's a simpler metric than whether the 10 tasks I told you to go do are actually going to move the needle in the way that you want them to.
So why aren't the biggest corporations in the world doing this? Or are they?
Yeah, I mean, the ING is the biggest example that I've worked with personally. And you've got companies like Boston Consulting Group that are trying to get other groups to do this. There are a lot of poor implementations of scaled agile, but there are also successful implementations of scaled agile. And that's what this is. If you look at organizations that have huge engineering groups that are agile, they didn't all stop functioning because their individual tasks were not being managed. So I think that scaled agile has happened all over the place. Sometimes not with great outcomes, sometimes with very positive outcomes. Lean manufacturing reached into the very bowels of organizations and formed teams so that people could do continuous improvement. And so I think that that's been around for 70 years now. And so I think that there's all sorts of examples of that as well. So I guess I don't want to, the easy mistake is to think that what we're doing is going into the factory floor and putting together a cross-functional team arbitrary. But that's not what the point is. If there's low uncertainty, then you're not doing a cross-functional team. But you're still forming the team because you want the structure, the social structure of the team in alignment with the mission. And so you're not necessarily telling them exactly what to do. That team should already know what to do. And so you're not micromanaging individuals to figure out what tasks that they should be up to and asking them, did they accomplish their tasks last week? You're looking at what the desired outcomes are. And are you achieving the desired outcomes?
In your book, you say that disruption-proof organizations are RAD. Tell me about RAD.
Yeah, well, that's a little bit of a SoCal surf culture creeping into the book a little bit, but RAD stands for resilient. So resilient is the idea that you've got, you know, your core strength, your core DNA, you're firmly rooted to the shoreline, yet you actually are flexible and you bend in the wind like a tropical tree. The A is awareness. And so inside of a hierarchical command and control organization, decisions are made at the center of the company, and yet disruptions that occur on the edge. Supply chain issues, the whims of customers changing their minds, factories being closed on the other side of the world because of a looming pandemic. That's all information that exists outside of the core of the company. And so you need to start purposefully building this more global awareness into the company, out on the edge of the company, decentralized decision-making, but also implementing purposeful communications flows that gets that new information back into the core of the company and across the company to those that need to know. And then the D is for dynamic. And so that's the ability to change plans based upon new information. So back in the mid-2000s, Nokia had a 5-year plan for what handsets they were going to produce. 2007, the iPhone comes out. 2008, the iPhone takes over the world. 2009, Nokia is still producing the phones on their 5-year plan, right? And so that kills organizations if you're not able to respond. And so, it's a purposeful construction of agility. And this is another thing where the team orientation benefits. If a team is actually getting together and discussing how to improve their work or whether there's new information that means that they ought to change what they're doing, then that's what builds the dynamism in a company. And so there's organizations that for the last 10 years have all, told me, oh, well, we're in hardware. You know, we can't do lean innovation. We can't do this rapid experimentation. And I always ask the question, you've gone through a massive product failure before. Was there nothing that you could have tested before you launched that product that might have given you an indication that you didn't have everything right? And of course, they come up with a myriad ways that they could have done it looking backwards. So the idea of behaving in this way and building into the schedule, building into the process, this idea that you're going to stop your work for a day or half a day or an hour, whatever time period you want, a week, a month, 3 months, 6 months, we're going to pause. We're going to take in new information. And then we're going to discuss whether we need to change what we're up to based upon the new information. We're going to check in with our stakeholders. We're going to look at the environment.
That doesn't work because we've got to follow the plan.
Right. Yes, follow the plan right into failure.
Mm-hmm.
But see, that's what the funny thing is that entrepreneurs are the ones that are supposed to be risk takers, but entrepreneurs aren't risk takers. Entrepreneurs are the ones that actually purposely de-risk a company or an idea. The people that are actually accepting the risk are the ones that choose to do nothing and just to work on their biases and their assumptions because they don't want to face the risk.
I tried to attribute this quote directly to you, but I couldn't actually, but somebody wrote about it when writing about you. And it was that business is a science and startups are experiments.
And what are experiments? I don't know if that was, I don't know if that was me. I don't know if that was me.
Well, what's your view on that? Because that kind of feels a little bit like what we're talking about here in terms of the joy of startups, the joy of smaller businesses is it's all just one big experiment. Because we don't actually know until we do it. And the bit that I was kind of hoping you'd say, yeah, that was my quote, absolutely. It was just written in the context of you. Because I was intrigued by that idea that business is a science. And sciences are things where you can get a predictable outcome from predictable inputs.
After running hundreds of experiments, right? It's not about believing your assumptions. It's about testing your assumptions.
Well, my follow-up to that was, so what is the formula of business? But I guess you've sidestepped that question by saying it really wasn't your quote. So we'll move on swiftly from that.
Well, I mean, I whenever I talk about it, I put it into scare quotes, which doesn't come across in text. But so what I say is that we apply the scientific method, and I use scare quotes because we're dealing with human beings here, right? Whenever you're trying something entrepreneurial, you're trying to get somebody to change their behavior, and that's not rational. People don't change their behavior just because your product is easier to use or just because it has it does a better job. There's all sorts of reasons that people don't change their minds. And one of the startups I was at, we had a product that was way less expensive and way higher performing than the 800-pound gorilla in the market. But we had to, if IT people wanted to implement our solution, they would have to forklift our products out of the data warehouse. Well, IT managers are like, listen, I've got budget for this other product already. Why am I going to forklift all this equipment out and take the risk that even if your products work perfectly, something happens during the changeover, right? So there's all sorts of reasons why people don't change their behavior. And that's what we need to test. We need to figure out whether people are willing to. So they have a particular, do they have a need? Is that need a high priority item enough that they'd be willing to change what they're doing today in order to take a shot at a new solution? These things are not just science. They're human non-rational behavior that we have to get into and understand in order to make our businesses successful and grow.
So one question I have for you is that a lot of the companies you cite, product-based companies, right? How does all of this translate into a service-based business?
Well, what I love about service-based business is that it's easy to run an experiment because all you have to do is go try to sell it. And if nobody buys it, that's a failed experiment. If somebody buys it, well, then you have to go put your services together. But that's relatively easy to do, right? So when we were a young company, we sold an accelerator program. I think it was to FedEx, actually. And we had not put any of the curriculum together. And so while we were servicing a bunch of other companies, we were 1 week ahead of the game creating the curriculum for the next week inside the accelerator program. And so that was an experiment that was somewhat successful, but it also was maybe a very immature product because we didn't have that much time to vet it before we went and executed it. But that's the nice thing about services. You can just go sell it. So I think
that was an experiment we were doing. We were learning as we were doing.
That's right. Exactly right. Yep. And then we iterated upon it. And, you know, several years later, we sold a bunch of experiments because we had figured something out. Or a bunch of accelerators because we figured it out.
Great. So our time's coming towards an end. I think I'm interested in that. Really, what I've heard from you so far is that our core audience, the guys and girls out there that are running smaller and start-up and early-stage businesses, they've actually got all the tools to be successful. So they've got decentralized organizations, and they've got dynamism, and they've got creativity, and they've got empowerment, and they've got the ability to be agile and learn quickly and be outcome-driven. Is there anything that you would like to say to our audience that you would implore them to use in their business?
Well, so I think that the way you hold on to that is to be aware of it. So I think that it's great that they've been able to start out as a RAD. And so I think that it's to hold on to that ethos. And, you know, as you try to scale, there are parts of the business that need to be just operationalized. But in my view, you still keep that operation on teams so that they can hold each other accountable more than a manager having to micromanage them. That's number one. And number two, look for other opportunities inside your company to apply that RAD mindset. So it's just like the HR example I was giving before. It could even be sales. It could be, you know, our sales script isn't working anymore. So let's do spin up a team that's going to very quickly test out, run experiments on what's a new sales script. Or it could be, you know, what's a new market segment that we could go after. So anywhere where there's uncertainty, you can spin up, and it doesn't have to be like full time. It's like 15% of your time is going to go tackle this uncertainty. And so you're starting to add this purposeful construction of how to reduce uncertainty in your organization, no matter how small you are. And then that is what allows you to maintain that culture as you grow. So it's not just the big things. What are the new products that we should launch? Should we start selling overseas or whatever? It's where are the small uncertainties that I can put together a team and they're going to go tackle that uncertainty. And that's going to drive impact in our business, whether the impact is small or big. And that builds that culture of creativity and intelligence and empowerment. And it maintains that culture even as you scale.
I do like I do love the focus on uncertainty. I think over a series of number of these podcasts, we've kind of said entrepreneurs aren't risk takers. They're not courageous simply because of the way that they de-skill things. But I think if you can come back and say, okay, they're the people who can remove uncertainty, that's something very interesting. Yeah.
Right. Removing uncertainty de-risks the company.
Yeah. Definitely.
There's a quote that you can attribute to me.
Brad, thanks so much for joining us. It's been absolutely excellent. Great. And your weather in California is just a little bit nicer than I have in the west of Scotland.
And
go ahead.
No, I was going to say before we get onto that, how do people find out more about you?
So I have a website, BrantCooper.com, and I've got a small entrepreneur curriculum I'm building at StartupBlueBook.com. And of course, I'm Brant Cooper on all social media, and I really encourage your listeners to reach out. I respond to all messages, Brant@BrantCooper.com. For anybody that's interested in the work that we're doing with big businesses, that's at MovesTheNeedle.com. And I was just going to throw out there that in the middle of September, I'm going to come to Scotland for a week. First time I've ever visited. So I'm really looking forward to that. I got ancestors from that area. So I'm going to go do some ancestor worship in Scotland.
Well, look me up when you're coming over and let me know. And if you're anywhere near Glasgow, I'll buy you a beer.
That sounds like a deal. I will let you know as we flesh out our itinerary.
There was one other thing that you've got a Slack group as well for a community. How does that work?
We've actually put that on pause. Innovation Champions as we focus on some of the other things that we're doing. But I do monthly Q&A sessions. Sometimes they talk about the book, but also things like scaling agile. And so if people have questions that they want to direct at me, they can join on there. Just track me on LinkedIn, and it would be great to have your listeners participate.
Excellent.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us, Brian. And to our wonderful listeners, here's an invitation. If you want to take it up to get in touch with Brian, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast.
Many thanks for taking the time to listen to the podcast today. If you like what you hear, please leave a review or subscribe. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, all the main podcasting sites. And if you'd like to learn more from us, you can contact Alan. He's alan@tbgp.co.uk. And you can find me at info@atomcto.com.